This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Candace Cox was working as a representative with American Airlines at Raleigh-Durham Airport when she was thrust into the role of political activist. Candace is a transgender woman, and after the enactment of North Carolina's House Bill 2, she was told that she should use the handicapped bathroom instead of the one that aligned with her gender identity. Not long after that, she found herself at press conferences and speaking with lawmakers about the rights of transgender North Carolinians. And in many ways, she was ready for that role. She was raised by generations of strong women, and her own struggle with her gender identity readied her to fight for others. Today, Candace Cox is an advocate for LGBTQ rights and a board member of Equality NC, and she joins me now. Candace Cox, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's take us back. We're going to talk about your journey, certainly, talk about HB2 and how you found yourself in the political spotlight. But you're not from here. You're from Syracuse, New York, right?
Oh, yeah. Syracuse.
Tell us about growing up in Syracuse.
It was very cold growing up.
Yes, well, I was just down the block in Buffalo, so I know what you mean.
Yeah. I struggle to tell people where I grew up because I was a surprise baby for my mom. I like to say surprise baby because that sounds a lot better than saying that my mother didn't have much of a choice in the conception of me and had a child and was young and just kind of had to quickly make do. And so she dropped out of college and got a job and tried to raise a child. And then we moved a lot. As mom decided to go back to college and then medical school and then residency. So
when you say not much of a choice, can you tell us more about that? Because I think it's more than just the choice whether to have the baby or not, right?
For my mother, there was not much of a choice because of her faith. I'm born and raised Catholic, practicing, and we believe that, and by we, my family, we certainly believe in a woman's right to choose, but my mother certainly believes that she had no choice but to have this gift that God gave her.
So she had a baby. And tell us about growing up, because then you kind of grew up in a house full of women, or at least...
I did. I was born into the house that my great-grandmother had bought, and she was alive. My grandmother, my aunt, and my mother... We all lived in this one big, massive house on the south side of Syracuse. And those were my role models. That's what I have tried to embody, was seeing these strong Black women who overcame all adversity. My great-grandmother bought the house in the early 1960s when they refused to sell a home to an African-American woman. So she found a way to provide for her family and had a white friend buy it and bought it from them.
And this was, as you say, back in the 60s, resourceful, a woman who's going to buy property, understands that in the 1960s. And then you're living in that house with all of them.
Well, you're not,
yeah. So what kind of influence and what sort of role did they play in your upbringing? What was it like for them and you?
I was the firstborn of my generation. So I was my grandmother's first, my great-grandmother's first. My grandmother is and was my rock. My mom got her first job after I was born, was working for US Air, so we flew for free. So every weekend, my grandmother had me traipsing up and down the East Coast. What I learned early on from them was that the person that you are when you go out in public doesn't just represent you. It represents the entirety of our family. And our family's success hinges upon each person putting their best foot forward and being the best person that they can be. I know that that sounds very abstract, but that was a daily theme that was pushed on me since as early as I can remember.
Yeah, but it sounds like a lot of pressure, too.
Well, there's a lot of pressure on being Black, so...
But that's what I mean, the idea that you were conscious of that and that they wanted you to be conscious of that. How do you take that on board? Because later on, as an adult, you can see the importance of that. I mean, this is fundamentally true, you know.
Yeah.
This is the way white culture looks and perceives all of this. But as a young person, I'm wondering how you're perceiving that mandate, right? To that imperative that you are carrying with you so much.
You know, it's really weird. Up until now, I've never seen it as something that was a burden or a stressor or something. I actually saw it as a point of pride that my family saw something in me that was worthy of taking pride in. Mm. And that's how that's actually how I've always envisioned it in my mind, is that we say, look at who we are and what we've done. My grandmother or my great grandmother went to college in the 1940s, a black woman in Chicago, and became a nurse. My grandmother, 5 children, my grandfather died, and she never asked for help and raised all 5 of them. And all 5 went on to higher education, attaining success, and being wonderful people. Look at who we are. Be proud of that. And that's what you come from, so be proud. So for me, it was always a good thing.
Your mother, too, went through a number of hardships as a young woman and taught you about persistence. Talk more about that.
My mom, surviving, being a survivor of rape, being a lesbian, being a black woman, and a single mother, it would have been very easy for my mother to rest on the difficulties that she had faced, losing her father. And my mother taught me very early on that the only thing at the end of the day that matters is you as an individual and how you overcome odds. My mom never made excuses growing up. I never heard my mother talk about how difficult anything was. I didn't know that things were difficult for her until I became an adult. Mm. To me, she did everything with such ease and effort. And that's what she wanted to push on me, was being black is not an acceptable excuse for not being successful. Yes, you have to work harder, but that is our lot in life. It's not a lot, but it's our life.
And she even helped you with what for her must have been a pretty difficult mission. You at some point wanted to find your father.
I have. I became very curious about my dad when I entered grade school, and all the other kids and their parents would always, you know, inquire, oh, what do your parents do? Mm-hmm. And I felt as though I had this scarlet letter on me, because I couldn't say what my parents did, because I knew that parents had that connotation of mother and father. And my father didn't want to acknowledge my existence since birth, so I couldn't tell people. And so I had lingering questions. I wanted to know why I wasn't loved. And it wasn't until I got to be quite a bit older, in my later teen years, and my mother remarried, that I started to realize that my father represented nothing to me. And my quest for him was not going to make me complete, and it wasn't going to answer people's questions. My problem was I was trying to make my life conform to what people wanted it to be, instead of telling people who I was.
When did that insight strike you?
Oh, gosh. Probably around junior year of high school, when I thought I was gay and told my friends. Because that's when I realized that people had certain expectations of me, and I didn't meet those expectations, and that was okay, but I had to learn how to articulate who I was. And I think that's when I started to have this realization of I was supposed to be taking pride, that pride I talked about early on in who I was, and putting that best face forward and not apologizing for my family.
It's interesting, if you hadn't had all of that background and that briefing that you had, right, this kind of sturdy inculcation and reinforcement about your identity. We're proud people. We are proud of who we are. Be proud. think about the multiple confusions. I mean, number one, who am I? Where's my dad? Well, who loves me? And then as you begin to wonder about your gender identity, you could have very easily gone the other way. That confusion throws a lot of people into chaos.
It does. It did cause some confusion for me. Yeah. Like I said, I thought I was gay.
Yeah.
I knew that I wanted to be a girl since I was 6 years old. I said it to my mom when I was 8 years old, I think. I begged my mom for a pink skirt and a pink sweater, and I promised I would only wear it at home, and she did. And I would come home every day, and I would wear that and play and do my homework. I knew who I was, but I always think of myself as a fatalist of, well, this is the body God gave me. This is the world God gave me. So I didn't push that as I got older because I was 6 feet tall. I was a boy. People saw me as a boy. So I tried to fill that role, and I thought, well, maybe I'm not a girl. Maybe I'm gay. And I was very unhappy because I felt like I was living a lie. I was not being true to myself, and I wasn't proud of who I was because what I was doing felt so unnatural. It was so difficult to take pride in it.
We'll talk about how that turned out when my conversation with Candace Cox, who is a gender and sexuality educator, also an advocate for LGBTQ rights and the community here in North Carolina. Just ahead, we'll hear about how she got active in politics, and we'll talk about it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking with Candace Cox, a transgender woman, gender and sexuality educator, and advocate for LGBTQ communities in North Carolina. You're talking about when you first, in high school, began to question your gender identity. But your family was very supportive, your mother, your grandmother, all through this. So were you able to talk to them right away?
I could have, but I didn't. Obviously, I was a teen, and at that point, I had been influenced by society. I'd heard the names, and so I didn't want to disappoint them because I had lived this charade for so long. There were expectations of the man I would become.
I mean, that's interesting because by then, did you know your mother was a lesbian?
Oh, yeah. That was never a secret,
right.
But it was never something major to talk about.
I mean, it just shines such a bright light on how cultural expectations. Here you are in a home where when you were eight, your mother happily got you the pink dress, if that's what you asked for. She's a lesbian, you know this, and yet there's something, those cultural expectations are so strong that while you may not have been afraid, you weren't ready to talk about it yet.
Well, I think that oftentimes people think, oh, I grew up in such a progressive household with a lesbian mom. It must have been very easy. No. There were still my parents. Like everyone's parents, my parents didn't come with a sexuality. My parents came with a parental thing. And the fear of disappointing one's parents is insurmountable. You know, I think it doesn't matter who your parents are. You don't want to tell your parents that you are anything other than what they think you are.
When did you have that conversation?
I had that conversation when my mother had that conversation with me. I graduated high school, went to college, left college, went to Australia on this quest to find myself. Left there, contemplated joining the military, went through a number of things that I thought would fulfill me. And my parents paid for it all along the way. And I was 21 years old. My mom picked me up from the airport, and she said, enough is enough. And she said, do you remember when you told me that you wanted to be a girl? And I said, yes. And she said, do you still feel that way? And I said, yes. And she said, why haven't you told me that? That's what you're looking for. And if that's who you really are and you want to be, then I will help you explore it.
And she did. And how did you? Because she was helpful in helping you explore that.
Oh, she was very helpful. Yeah. I mean, she paid for everything, got me the best help in the world, found me experts and doctors to talk to and therapists, paid for hormone replacement therapy, paid for trips to Thailand for plastic surgery. She may have lost a child, which are her words, but she, both of my parents also gave birth again to who I am now. They made it possible for me to live.
And just to take a look at what's happening with her, your mother actually went back to college, right, to pursue medicine. This was when you were 8 years old. Just to
when I was 8 years
back.
Old, yeah. She left the airlines with no job whatsoever, no help, moved by herself with me to North Carolina, went to Wake Tech trying to find herself. They said, "You're too smart." Sent her to North Carolina Central University. She became a Marx scholar, went to Los Alamos and did research, got a scholarship, and went to Wake Forest University School of Medicine, then Bowman Gray, and
I just didn't want to leave out that part of the story because we've moved a little bit past it because that happened when you were younger. And also you talked about the help that she gave you when you, for the therapies that you had in your transition. But before that, for a while, you thought you were gay. And
I did.
And so talk about those teen years and when you're 18 years old, I guess, your first gay bar.
I did. I went to my first gay bar. I met my best friend, who's still my best friend. And it was the first time I saw there was a drag show. And one of the performers had breast implants, and she had long, gorgeous hair. And that was the first time I saw a transgender woman in person, and I was enamored. And I had this sudden realization of, so this can be physically done. I was convinced that I couldn't look like a woman, that a man couldn't outside of drag, which felt unnatural. Mm. Which I did actually try to do for a while. I tried to do drag thinking I would quell that urge, mm-hmm. which I didn't because I'm a girl. I'm not a caricature, and I'm not for entertainment purposes. But 18, I saw my first trans woman and I was hooked.
And talk about those experiences a little bit more about the drag experience for you, because you realize, first of all, it's an art form, but secondly, it's a kind of commodification. So talk more about your feelings about it and your what it was like for you to even to try that.
For me, it was wonderful to try it because it gave me a safe venue to explore gender roles. Mm. In mainstream society, we don't have that. And within the LGBTQ community, I did have that. I just didn't like the entertainment aspects. But what I actually gained more from my years of experimenting with drag was a respect that is difficult to articulate for the LGBTQ community, because it was only then that I started to see people who were struggling with acceptance in their family and their community and themselves, and yet they persevered.
Mm.
And I saw people do things that were unthinkable to be their authentic selves. Mm. And I thought, that's not fair.
And beyond your own observations, you also found mentors in this community. Is that right?
I did.
Who helped you through? Tell us more about that.
I did. I don't think of them as mentors. We're all shaped by our social network. We learn. To me, a friend is someone who should challenge you every day to be a better you, and someone who is smarter than you. And I learned that from a lot of those queens. They taught me a lot about not just the physical aesthetics of looking how to transform into a woman, but how to walk past the people who speak ill of you, and how to continue to hold your head up high, how to persevere in a world that says you are unworthy. I learned that from them.
And what did you learn?
I learned that it is not what people call you that defines you. Mm. It is you. And that the only power anyone has over you is the power that you give them. And by not acknowledging, you take away their power because now they're talking to themselves.
How does that play out, though, if you think about the number of people who are facing this, right, who face these kinds of obstructions in their own path to expressing themselves, to be who they are? It just seems to me that takes a lot of work. It's not that it shouldn't be done, but there's also this greater responsibility, you know, not to do that, right? Not to create laws that make people feel other and that create this subordinate society. What's the admixture there of kind of perseverance and personal will and then advocacy, which is the other part of it that you do, right? That making sure that society doesn't put people in that situation.
I'm not sure I could actually know how to answer that.
Well, let's talk more about. I'll let you think about that because we're going to talk more about advocacy as we move through the conversation. But talk more about the transformation yourself, your transition, because your mother was a big supporter, and you actually went to Thailand together, right?
The first trip.
Yeah, tell us about that.
It was hot. my mom is a miracle worker. She got a new job and got a sign-on bonus and called me and said, God gave me this gift and we're going to use it. Let's go to Thailand. And we went. She helped me research doctors. She sat there and talked with the doctor and spoke doctor lingo. She wanted to ensure that her child was taken care of in every possible way. And it was a wonderful bonding experience, aside from the trip, for my mom and I just to have that time together. But it was wonderful because I think that's where a lot of my strength comes from, is the fact that in my new rebirth as my authentic self, the woman who gave birth to me was the first person I saw. She was the first one who I saw when I entered this world. She was the first person I saw when I woke up. Technically, my surgeon was, but my mom. And I think that actually did more for me than any lesson she taught.
Interesting. Which that speaks also to the complexity of this kind of transition. You speak so eloquently of sort of the of wanting to be your authentic self, and this is what this transition will do. I'm, in a sense, living a lie. I think I'm putting words in your mouth here, and you can correct me, certainly. But the idea is that you want everything to conform to how you feel. So if you hear that, you think, ah, finally, relief, I can be. But there is this other identity. You've been living in this body for a long time. People know you in that other body. What's going through your mind as you imagine all the ways identity will change after this transition?
It took my transition for me to realize that my identity was not something that was a physical manifestation. My identity was how I perceived myself and how I interacted. My mother taught me early on that both of my parents, being a lesbian was not a qualifier. It was nothing that defined who you were. When I said to my mom, I think I'm gay, the immediate response was, that's fine, you still have to do your homework. That is a true story. That lesson is, it doesn't matter. People knew me before. People know me now. I am still the same person. My expectations of myself and humanity remain the same. The only thing that has changed is how I look to people and my interactions on a small degree. But it was only after my transition that I realized I've always been me.
Mm. How about your grandmother? How was she? What was she doing through all of this?
Be a lady. That's it. That is it. My grandmother, she loves me unconditionally. And for her, it doesn't matter what you are. Just don't embarrass this family.
Well, aside from radical approval, what else did that line mean for you, be a lady? Yeah.
It meant to me that the same expectations are there. I was still expected to go to college, get a good education, be successful, go to church, be charitable, be kind to others, recognize that there is something in this world that is bigger than me and will outlive me, and recognize that transgender, not transgender, you still represent this family. So don't make us look bad.
What about religion through this whole period? Was that important to you?
Religion is very important to me. My faith with God is my faith, and I love it. I know that people get confused because they say there are teachings within Catholicism that go against it. And yes, there are. There are teachings that man has interpreted and adopted and preached, and I do not believe those things to be true. I believe that faith is something that is personal. It's a personal journey. I do love the history of Catholicism. I do love the tradition and what it's meant for my family. And my faith is what gets me through a lot of things, because my mother always said, and I believe it, that this too shall pass, and God does not put us through anything that we cannot overcome and handle.
Were you able to go to church through this whole period, or was your faith something that you kept to yourself?
No, I've always maintained going to church. I think that for me, a lot of it has just been blind ignorance. I just went to church. I didn't see any problem with it. I went to church as a boy. As a boy, I had to dress a certain way and act a certain way. As a girl, I dressed a certain way and acted a certain way. I never asked people whether or not I fit in or belonged somewhere.
Did you ever have a sense, though, that those teachings, and you may not have heard that sermon, maybe that just didn't happen on the Sunday you were there, but some of those teachings, or even knowing about the way some Christian churches and some Catholic churches as a subset of Christianity teach about transgender and, that whole question of gender and the way it's treated. Was that an issue for you?
No, it was an issue for me, because as someone who loves history and loves everything, I easily go back to slavery in the United States, when slave owners would look at their African-American slaves and say, from the Bible, we know that because Cain killed Abel, God marked him with the darker skin, and therefore he was meant to be enslaved, and that's why black people are subservient. I know that's not true, and yet that was a teaching that people pulled and interpreted. So that's my approach to many of those teachings now.
Let's talk about what happened afterward. After the transition, you came back, and your experience, what was your experience then with your friends and social life? Were you able to just resume, pick it up, or what happened next?
I tried. For my social life, it was interesting. My friends, a lot of questions. The harder part was romantic life. We all want love. And I struggled for a very long time with understanding what love was and self-worth. I ended up finding myself in a very bad, abusive relationship with someone who told me that I was weird and a freak and unworthy. And that was hard.
You began that relationship. Talk a little bit more about that and his understanding going into the relationship and then what happened, because he was with you through the transition.
He was.
And things changed afterwards. So talk more about that.
We met when I had first started my transition. So I was living full time as Candace, but I hadn't had any plastic surgery. So every night I disrobed. He said that he wanted to be with a woman, and he came from a very conservative family. And as my transition progressed, he developed more and more disdain for who I was and disgust. And once I completed my surgery for my personal journey, my SRS, he realized that he didn't want to be with a woman, that what he wanted was to be with a man, but to be with someone who could look like a woman in public so that society would accept him. Not to insult who he was, but I now realize how weak of a person he was, that he needed that acceptance.
You realize that now, but it was difficult for you. In fact, when he left, you followed, right?
He did. He left me and went to Atlanta, and I went after him. It's so embarrassing. He completely rejected me, and I was destitute. Shame prevented me from coming back to North Carolina where we were living. So I said, I'm going to go to New Orleans and start over again. It's my favorite place. So I went there, and I tried to get a job, but it was a tourism city, and I was on Bourbon Street, and other people said how beautiful I was. Oh, you're gorgeous. You're gorgeous. You should go to this club and get a job. And I thought, okay. And it was a strip club for trans women. And I thought, this is degrading. And I tried to do it for a couple of days. And I just said, this is terrible, especially because they said, you must have male genitalia but look like a girl. And I didn't. And I thought, are you serious? You want to objectify a transgender person's body and you want to define who they are and what they are and turn them into these people who deserve no humanity and no respect. And I met a lot of girls there, and that was the birth of my advocacy, when I reflect, was meeting some of the girls that worked there.
We'll talk more about that when my conversation with Candace Cox continues, a gender and sexuality educator, also an advocate for LGBTQ communities in North Carolina. That conversation continues on The State of Things in just a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Candace Cox, transgender woman, a gender and sexuality educator, advocate for the LGBTQ community, and a board member of Equality NC. So we left you in New Orleans. You had worked very, very briefly with at a strip club and then decided to leave. Now what?
Yeah, now what?
Yeah.
I came back to North Carolina, and I realized that I had to swallow my pride. My pride was what was my impetus. And so I slept on my grandmother's couch and walked a mile every day till I found a job waiting tables, saved money. And my parents give a little tough love, and I realized I needed to stop asking for help because I had only completed half of who I was. I now had to prove myself worth to myself.
Well, tough love. What were they saying to you?
No more money.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You have you need to find what you want in this world. We made you this person. We raised you. That's our job. It is your job now to make a way for yourself in this world. So that's what I then decided to do, and went, waited tables, saved money, bought a car, met my now husband while I was waiting tables. He was a customer and thought I was gorgeous. And decided an education is going to be something that no one can take away from me. And it's going to be one more of those things that makes me stand up with pride. So I enrolled myself at North Carolina State University and decided to go back and get that education and get a fine, upstanding job.
What'd you study?
Sociology and history. I love history. History of North Carolina in particular.
Mm-hmm. All right. So then the job. What happens next?
Then I get a phone call after HB2. We could fast forward. And
yeah.
I got a phone call from a friend who was a photographer and said, hey, Candace, you know that bathroom bill that got passed? And I'm like, yeah, I saw it on the news. Well, Chad Griffin and Chris Groh, respective presidents of Equality North Carolina and HRC National, are meeting, and they are dropping off a letter at the governor's mansion, and they want to meet some transgender people to hear their stories, to take those stories with them to the governor.
I want to stop you right there on the road to the governor's office, because before that, you had also had an encounter. You had to come to terms with that. You were working at, American Airlines?
Yes.
And so that was your first encounter with HB2, right? I mean, the fact that you had to come to terms with which bathroom you're going to use.
Yes. So, and actually the meeting happened shortly thereafter. It just happened to be I was on vacation during a period. I was at American Airlines. The law came up, and it threw a wrench in things, and I went to my management, and I said, what do I do? And my manager said, I think you're making a big deal out of this. You look like a girl. What's the problem? And I thought, I'm a law-abiding abiding citizen.
You raised Catholic, after all, so
right.
The rules matter.
Yeah, okay. Rules do matter. Okay. I escalated to legal, and they said they reviewed the law, and they couldn't understand what the problem was. And I thought, You are lawyers for the world's largest airline, but you do not understand this law, which is basic. And then I started to get picked on by management and ostracized and pointed out, and went from getting a letter from the president of the company because I was such a stellar employee to, it's an issue how many times I'm going to the bathroom and people are taking pictures of me and counting how many times I'm gone and timing me.
Which bathroom were you using by then, and had they suggested a bathroom? Or
they told me to use the handicap bathroom, which was embarrassing. Mm. Because people would go, where are you going? The women's restroom is right there. I have to go to the handicap restroom. Why? And I was forced to out myself to a lot of coworkers at that point, which I'm okay being outed. I'd like to be the one in control.
And as you say, now there's a certain degree of what I would call harassment, right? They're taking photos. They're yes. logging your bathroom time. So is that, when did Chris Groh and Chad talk to HRC, by the way, the Human Rights Commission, right? Human Rights Campaign. Mm-hmm. So these are the leaders of those two, Equality North Carolina, Human Rights Campaign, come to you and want you to meet with the governor?
Yeah. So they didn't come to me. It was certainly the, would you meet with them? And I thought, sure. I have to be at work later on that day. And it was very hot. So I went and I'm sitting there with these two guys and they're talking and I'm like, I have to be at work in like 5 hours. And they said, well, we're going to walk over to the governor's mansion now. Walk with us, Candace, and talk. So I'm walking and talking. And I'm honestly thinking that I'm going to get to the Capitol building and they're going to take the letter in. And I'm going to go to my car and say, that was so stupid. And they said, who's coming in to meet with the governor? And Chad goes, we are. And he says, okay, just you two. And he said, well, no. This is about attacking transgender people, so we need a trans person. Who? And then they look at me, because I'm standing there, Candace. And I'm like, is doing what? And a second later, I mean, before I can process anything, I am walking through the metal detector and across the marble floor of the state seal to the governor's office.
You were there. How did they find out about you? Why did they?
The photographer. They had hired a photographer to photograph the event, and the photographer just happened to know me socially. And he was like,
no, but I mean Chad and Chris Groh. Why did they contact you in the first place?
Well, no. They asked the photographer.
Oh, I get it. Okay.
Do you know some trans people?
I get it. And now you're there. So this is former governor Pat McCrory, and you're in his office.
Yeah.
What happens next?
Chief of staff and communication director. He's sitting there in disbelief when I said I'm transgender, and his jaw hit the floor. And he just stared at me in disbelief the entire time. And the conversation didn't go far, but it was not lost on me instantaneously that what I was doing would be historic, that I would be the only transgender person he would meet with.
This is quite a role. Imagine this. You had not prepared yourself to talk with anybody about this, no less the governor. What do you say in a situation like that?
I had prepared myself. I had 35 years of preparation going into it. I didn't need to tell him any anecdote. I didn't need to tell him any legislative anything or cite any laws. I just needed to tell him, I live here. I'm a person. This hurts me. And how? But not just me, but everyone who is like me. And, yeah, so I had
And how? I mean, what do you say to somebody like that who, you know, may not be aware of kind of the impact this has, because for him and for the people who passed legislation like that, these are other people. Now he's sitting in front of you and having to listen. So what do you say to try to bridge that gap and to sort of help him understand what you're going through? What do you say?
You remind them of the person that you are and the human that you are. I tried to break down the labels and get rid of the transgender, men dressing as women going into restrooms. I described to him what my life was like, my husband and I, our home that we had just bought at the time, a year before, our mortgage, the fact that my grandmother loved the beach, and I was hoping to take her to the beach a couple of times, so I needed to save the money. And how working for the airline gave me such pride and flight benefits, and I could fly my family. And that now, that same thing that provided for me and my life and my family because of this law was something that was a point of contention in my life and was difficult, and that he, as the executive of this state and the representative of all North Carolinians, was standing or sitting before me saying, I am knowingly making your life more difficult and affecting the happiness of your family because I do not believe that you are equal.
How did he respond?
He said that he hadn't fully read it. And he said that that's not what this was about, and that not everyone is like me.
He hadn't fully read it. You mean the bill?
Yeah, before he signed it.
He hadn't fully read the bill before he signed it?
Yes.
Former Governor Pat McCrory. So you have that meeting, and then you walk out. So you weren't quite expecting to have that meeting. You walk out, and there's a press conference.
Yeah, which I somehow missed the podium with the 80 cameras and microphones. And they said, Candace, what was it like? What did he say? What happened? And I was petrified, but I said to myself in that instance, remember, you represent this family. When you step out of the house, stand with pride. Don't give people any reason to look at you and poke holes. Hold your head up high, tell the truth, and be proud.
What did it feel like in that moment, again, to be asked these questions? I mean, I understand now this is strengthening you, right? Gives you some strength to go forward. But again, you hadn't expected to be a spokesperson
humbling.
For this. Yeah,
it felt very humbling to stand there and speak on behalf of every single person who had ever felt as though this government was not working for them. Felt humbling.
Since then, now the discussion about how to replace HB2, as we say, the people of North Carolina chose Roy Cooper in the next election, the next chance they had. He's the Democratic governor now, and it's his team who really works on this replacement bill. Talk about your feelings about that.
I think that, so one, I always like to point out, it doesn't matter to me if someone's a Democrat or a Republican. You stand for equality or you don't. I think that Governor Cooper has been in a difficult position because he wants to see our state move forward and be progressive. North Carolina has a history of being very progressive. And I think, I wish that he hadn't, but I think that he tried to compromise and be the good guy, which is something typically that would be admirable. But in this instance, I feel as though he didn't listen to the voices because he understood, and we have said, that the only repeal or the only fix is a full repeal, to just say, look, we screwed up, not we screwed up and let's change it a little bit. I'm like, there's nothing to change. Inequality is inequality.
Well, the bill, so we're talking about House Bill 142, and it repealed HB2 and then it replaced it with other legislation, and it removes the requirement that transgender people use the restroom that matches the sex on their birth certificate. But legislators are still in charge of the policy, and so it also took away the right of cities to defend the rights of individuals, transgender individuals. So cities no longer, according to the law, cannot protect the civil rights of individuals, transgender individuals, because of the law and this compromise. But it does remove that requirement that transgender people, which was an offensive requirement, right?
Yes, but for me that was not the most egregious part of it. It was the fact that the government was trying to define who I was and what being transgender meant and what steps one must take in one's personal journey. That was the worst part. And that's where we still are, is that we are still taking power away from cities, but also allowing the General Assembly to still say what I am, who I am, what I deserve. And the only thing that they should be doing is saying, how can we make North Carolina an easier, more inclusive place for people to succeed at life? It is not the job of any elected official to impede any individual person's happiness that God bestowed upon them.
So you have become more active. Talk about how that moment changed things for you and your much more outspoken activist life today.
I realized in that instance that what had been lacking up until that point was visibility. People had not seen a transgender person that they could relate to. And I realized then that God had put me in that position to say, I will stand here. I'll take the name calling because I can hold my head high. I will continue to be the visible person and to be the voice and to call out when something is unjust, because that's how we make change.
So how are you working now, and what are you working to accomplish these days?
Well, right now what we're working on, obviously, is we're in a midterm election, and I am working very diligently to help get progressive people elected, people who understand how we go about affecting change and passing equality, and educating people who are currently in office, people who want to be in office, educating the general population on what they can do, regardless of what laws are on the books in their own business and personal practices, to be more inclusive.
And how do you do that? You're visiting churches and other places. Talk.
I am.
About that.
I will go to the opening of an envelope, as they say. I've spoken with church groups. I try to meet people where they are and try to relate in every possible way. And I'm fortunate that this is how I get to make my livelihood now, traveling around the world, talking with groups. We would be here all day long if I named the different varied groups I get to speak with.
But what kind of conversations are you having, particularly with people who may not have been so aware?
The conversations I'm having are telling people, I want you to tell me your preconceived mm-hmm. notions. Like, I want to talk about it, because people need to be heard, mm-hmm. and people have assumptions that right. come from somewhere, and right. I want to know. And then I want you to learn to respect me. We don't have to agree mm-hmm. on anything, but we have to understand that we all deserve respect, and I want to respect you, and I ask for the same.
Candace Cox, a gender and sexuality educator and advocate for LGBTQ communities in North Carolina and a board member at Equality NC. Candace, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. This has been my pleasure.
Don't forget, we're going to talk about movies on the radio, but I want you to know that you can find out about Candace and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. And there you can also find out about movies on the radio, celebrating your favorite movies about moms. Yesterday, Mother's Day, May the month of Mother's Day. Submit your favorite films about mothers at SOTAWNC.org to be part of Movies on the Radio next time we're up. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.